welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gather to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at the University of Alaska Anchorage for a debate on corporate personhood conducted by the award-winning UAA Seawolves speech and debate team. The debate, including opposing student arguments and responses from UAA faculty, was recorded at UAA on February 2nd.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. We're thrilled that you are here with us tonight. My name is Libby Roderick. I'm the Associate Director of the Faculty Development Center at UAA and also the director of our Difficult Dialogues project. It's a partnership with APU. And since 2003, we've been sponsoring once a semester these public policy debates and forums and public discussions on a whole range of issues. We've looked at things like climate change. We've looked at whether the state has a role in marriage. We've looked at the Pebble Mine recently. Many, many different topics since then, under the belief that we really, really, really in this country need to model and practice ways of interacting with each other with respect. About issues that are of great importance and often great emotional charge to many of us, and this is one of them, I suspect. So we're really glad you're here. The way the evening unfolds is we start with our fabulous and award-winning UAA speech and debate team, and they are tasked with debating the proposition. Tonight it is, should the U.S. adopt a constitutional amendment banning corporate personhood? We've asked them to do that not because, sadly for them, anybody wins at the end of this debate, but because it's a really fast way for us to get a big picture of the landscape of positions that people hold out there. So they will do that. That will be followed by a faculty response panel. We have four faculty from different disciplines who are going to briefly weigh in on from their disciplinary perspective on the issues that we're wrestling with, and then we open it up to a facilitated discussion at the end. It is being podcast, so within the next couple of weeks you can hear it again if you are so inclined, and or people who you know who wanted to come and couldn't make it tonight can also hear it. I should say also, happy Groundhog Day. Happens to be my favorite holiday, underrated or uncelebrated. So with that, we'll go from there. Right into the debate, and please welcome Steve Johnson. He is the director of our very fine debate.
I'd probably do without that. It's a small enough room. My daughters and I were talking about Groundhog Day, and I told them that since the groundhog saw its shadow, we would have six more weeks of winter, and they celebrated thinking that was a quick end to winter. So, difference in perspective on what Groundhog Day means from here to there. Thank you all again for coming out tonight, and thank you to Libby and the whole crew from CAFE for helping us sponsor this. It's been a terrific relationship we developed over the past few years, and so we're delighted to have the chance to argue before an audience that's genuinely interested in the issues that we're debating. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the format of debate in which we participate, a modified version of which you're going to see tonight. I'll introduce the debaters and then provide you a little bit of context for what it is we're going to do and discuss tonight. We compete in the international intercollegiate format of debating, which is the most widely practiced format of debating around the world. It's modeled roughly on the type of debate that you might see in the British House of Commons. And so if there are any really dedicated policy wonks in the audience that watch Question Time with the Prime Minister on Sunday nights on C-SPAN at 6 o'clock, you can raise your hand. It's okay. You can be honest. You never know. Check it out. It's a lot of fun. The point is this, that the type of debate that we participate in, being modeled after the British House of Commons, involves a couple of things that are somewhat unfamiliar to American audiences and that are always good to introduce at least at the outset. One of those things is that the debaters who are going to be speaking for and against the motion, the proposition team here is going to be arguing on behalf of an amendment that would eliminate corporate personhood. The opposition is going to be arguing against the proposal of that amendment. During their speeches, each one of those speakers will have 1 7-minute speech that alternates between the proposition and the opposition. During those speeches, members from the opposing side can rise to ask them points of information. This happens after the first minute and before the last minute of each of those speeches. You'll know that a minute has elapsed because you hear a bell. Kelsey, it'll sound like this. Maybe. There you go. That will tell the debaters that they are free to ask questions of the person holding the floor. Those questions are designed to be brief interjections that call to task some argument the debater is making, that pose a relevant question that the debater should integrate the answer thereto into his or her speech, and that generally provide some liveliness in the interactivity between the debaters. One of the things that you are going to see is that the debater that's holding the floor doesn't have to take that point of information. It's at their discretion, and so you'll frequently see them sit the other side down just by waving at them like this or saying not at this time. They're not being rude. That's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to manage their time effectively so that they don't get taken off track by some of the questions or by too many questions that might be asked. The other feature of international intercollegiate debate that is common to the British House of Commons and also part of what we do as well is the audience interactivity portion. You'll get a chance later on to ask some questions or make comments of your own that you want to make. But during the debate, we encourage you to show support for the team that's arguing the position that you best identify with. The way that's traditionally done is to pound on something or someone next to you and say, "Hear, hear." It's a good time to practice that now so you get out of your... There you go. That is very invigorating for the debaters. They like that sort of reinforcement. It gets them more excited about the position they're arguing. So by all means, if there's some point that the debaters are making that you find particularly compelling, feel free to let them know by saying, "Hear, hear." You might get the audience involved more, too, and that makes part of the interactive portion of the debate a lot of fun. Let me introduce to you these debaters before you. They are all up-and-coming members of the debate team. First, arguing for the opposition is going to be Matt Stinson and Wiley Kaysen. Matt's a junior, majoring in history, minoring in philosophy. He has been with us for a couple of years now. He has been both a finalist one year and a champion another year at our Cabin Fever Debates, which is our intramural debating tournament that we host for UAA students who are not active on the competitive debate squad. I'll talk more about that in a second. Joining him is Wiley Kaysen, who is a junior, excuse me, well, I almost tried to promote you there, majoring in philosophy. Wiley traveled with Brittany Bennett to the World Universities Debating Championships, one of our four teams that was just recently at the World Universities Debating Championships, that did such a fine job there that they were, of the 65 American teams that were entered in the tournament, we were number two. Yale was first, we were second, Stanford was third. And out of the nearly 195 universities that were participating in the general event from all over the world, we were number eight in those. So, Brittany and Wiley are in part the credit for that, as is the rest of the team. Brittany is a senior majoring in natural sciences and environment and society. Speaking with her will be Matt Ostrander, who's a freshman joining us this year and majoring in political science and international relations. He moved up here from Hawaii, so we're still trying to figure out why he did that. I can't speak to his logical prowess, but nonetheless, he is here speaking before you, having spent a month in Hawaii over Christmas, so I'm not sure why we got him back, but we're glad that we did. A couple notes about upcoming events. If you enjoy watching debates, which I hope you do, there are some opportunities for you to see our debate team and other UAA students engaged in public debates in the next month and a half or so. Every Tuesday night between now and spring break, we are hosting our Cabin Fever Debates intramural debate tournament. As I said earlier, this is for students who aren't active on the competitive debate team. We had our first session this past Tuesday where we taught over 80 students how to debate, and we're now going to go through the next month and a half teaching them or having preliminary debates from which we will select a group of them to advance to the semifinals and eventually the final round that will be held on the week before spring break that will crown our 2012 Cabin Fever Debate Champion. That happens every Tuesday night. Those preliminary rounds happen every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. in SSB 118. The first two topics that we're going to be debating next Tuesday night, one of them has to do with whether or not states should require drug testing for all recipients of welfare. The other has to do with whether or not targeting nuclear scientists from Iran for assassination is a legitimate security strategy. So a couple of very interesting and pertinent issues that are going on right now. If you'd like to see some debate on those issues, by all means, join us. We would love to have you there next Tuesday night. The other event of which I'll let you know is a great opportunity we're very excited about. Stanford University, though they took third to our second, had a team that did very well, a single team that did very well at the World Debating Championships. They made it all the way to the grand final round. They were the only American team that was in the grand final round. We're fortunate to have the opportunity to bring them up here in March to debate against some of our debaters in an exhibition round. And so I'd like to let you all know about that. That's scheduled for March 29th. It's a Thursday night. We're going to have that over in the Arts 150 Music Hall. And that will start at 7 p.m. That should be a terrific debate. We don't yet have a topic for that one, but regardless of what it is, I promise that it will be a lively and intriguing debate, showcasing the talents of some of the best university debaters literally in the world. So with that, I would invite you to turn off cell phones or at least set them to airplane mode so that you don't interrupt the debaters. It's nice that they have a chance to interact with each other, but they don't want to interact with people who they don't know connected by your digital devices. And making sure that Kelsey is with us and ready. Absolutely. I'd like to call the host to order and provide Matthew the opportunity to argue first on behalf of the motion.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We recognize this debate is in part an expression with the dissatisfaction of the way wealth is distributed in the United States, and that corporations are, in fact, the scapegoat for that. But we have to also recognize that corporations have legitimate benefits. They do contribute to society in positive ways. But that does not justify the fact that they are having these natural rights, which ought to be only reserved for natural people. What we have to do is we have to remove them of these natural rights, because corporations are, in effect, vehicles for accumulating wealth. What they do is they accumulate wealth at the cost of individuals like us. What they will do is they will continue to use their extensive budgets to seek legal advantage, and we cannot let that happen. So this evening I'm going to bring to you 2 points. First, how corporations have overreached, and second, how corporate personhood threatens democracy. But before I do, I'm going to explain the model I would use to implement this amendment. So first, we would strip corporations of their claim to personhood and permanently invalidate their claim to any natural rights. And second, we would maintain the recognition of corporations as entities, but then give them these basic legal protections. So into my first point, corporations have overreached. Ladies and gentlemen, we have to recognize that something has changed. Natural persons are entitled to rights to protect them from government intrusion into their lives. We recognize that governments, you know, we don't want the government intruding into our lives. So thus, corporations, we have to recognize, ought to be regulated by government. Corporations ought to be regulated by government so they do not intrude and encroach upon our rights. But what we have seen, ladies and gentlemen, is that where corporations used to be held accountable, they are no longer being held accountable. What changed here is that corporations used to be given charters, which means the government established them. Thus, they were accountable to the government and, by extension, the people. Today, we don't see that. Today, we see that corporations aren't accountable to anyone, and they employ the same protections that we, as individuals, ought to have reserved only for us. Now, the justification for this was the 14th Amendment, providing equal rights to all people. And thus, corporations asserted that they were people because they paid taxes. Well, we disagree. Corporations consider themselves humans, and thus try to apply protections that ought only to be reserved for natural persons. For example, in 1975, the Crest Beverage Company suggested that because they were taxpayers, they were thus akin to people, and that they were entitled to Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination. But in many cases, these types of protections that corporations try to use go and harm people. In Marshall v. Barlow's Incorporated, Barlow's invoked the Fourth Amendment against individuals from the Office of Health and Safety who were looking to conduct routine inspections for the workplace. Well, the court ruled that these routine inspections were unconstitutional because corporations were persons. Now, it gets even worse. Riverdale Mills Corporation invoked the Fourth Amendment after they were charged with violating the Clean Water Act. For months, they dumped caustic waste into public sewers without any pretreatment, and they got away with it under the doctrine that corporations are people. The nature of corporations is that they are vehicles for accumulating wealth and avoiding culpability. They are profit-driven and will forever seek to increase their profits. They will look for legal loopholes forever. What we do today is remove these major loopholes in our legal system. We prevent corporate greed from taking over America.
You mischaracterize corporations as being profit-driven when corporations also include things like the NAACP and Planned Parenthood and organizations that are set up for ideological purposes, not just businesses.
Right. And I think me and Brittany will get to that later on in the debate. But first I'm going to go specifically into how corporate personhood threatens democracy, which is kind of a response to what you just said. Corporations can essentially spend whatever they want to influence the political process. Buckley v. Valeo in 1976 ruled that spending money to influence politics was constitutionally protected free speech. Now, this money is speech rhetoric, right? Corporations have come up with this idea so they can influence the political process. But what really happens here is that their idea of fair representation becomes representation in accordance with the amount of influence that you have. Now, that's not fairness, is it? The problem with corporate personhood is that corporations have injected themselves artificially into the political process. Corporations have imagined themselves to be individuals deserving of being part of this political process. They've imagined themselves as being just like citizens. But we believe, on Side Government Today, that individuals, people, should be involved in government. Citizens should be involved in government, not artificial entities. It's important to distinguish between the legal protections that corporations have and the natural rights that people have. Corporations are convenient legal fiction that are supposed to simply allow for easier regulation and for easier, you know, taxation. They're not really tangible things. They're not visible. We can't point to a corporation in this room because we can't identify it. They don't have the right to speech. They don't have the right to not be searched. They don't have the right to vote. They don't have the right to public office. Before I continue, go ahead, Matt.
You speak of corporations as if they were some sort of otherworldly force interfering with our politics, but really they're just an accumulation of the voices of the people that make up that corporation.
Well, not necessarily, because when you talk about accumulating the voices of the people, you're talking about accumulating voices of people like the individuals in this room, a wide variety of people. But what we see when corporations supposedly represent the view of the people, corporations represent the view of a single individual, or oftentimes, or a single group of individuals. They use massive money to pour their influence into politics where it does not belong. Now, the U.S. Constitution was created with political equality for all in mind. James Madison noted that the electors of government ought to be the people, not people who are richer, not people who are poorer, but the people themselves. The fair opportunity to take part and influence politics is a precondition to democracy. That precondition to democracy is being violated today, and it's going to continue to be violated unless we pass this constitutional amendment. An opportunity is not considered fair when corporations can spend millions of dollars and drown out the voices of people like us. Liberties protected by the principle of participation lose their value when greater people with greater private means are permitted to use that advantage to control the course of public debate. Ladies and gentlemen, what we ought to recognize tonight is that slavery is the legal fiction that people are property, but corporations as people is the legal fiction that corporations are people. It's all legal fiction, ladies and gentlemen, and we ought to step it out once and for all. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Believe it or not, in my speech, I'm not going to stand up here and tell you that corporations are human or the subject of individual biological lives worthy of equal protection as our own human lives, because if that were the case, and as we all know, Mitt Romney is then a serial killer from his time at Bain Capital. What I'm going to tell you is that corporations as people, as persons, legal entities, is, like Matt said, a convenient legal fiction that actually allows us to better protect the property rights and speech rights and individual rights that we have as people who end up making up these corporations. So my speech is going to have sort of three parts. The first of all is I'm going to talk about why this misguided, ineffective, and destructive policy ultimately hurts the rights that we have as people and why corporations have rights that are worthy of protection. Secondly, I'm going to talk about why his outrage when he sort of hints and alludes to the Citizens United case is misguided and a bit of a red herring in terms of our recent lifting of the restrictions on money as speech. And lastly, I'm going to talk about why this is such a dangerous policy with the United States' economy as an international actor and how it plays into the threat that we face from losing jobs overseas to other people who would be willing to give corporations the equal rights that they deserve. But first of all, I want to talk about why this collective action, which is corporations, the collective economic action of individuals, deserves rights and deserves protection as well. I want to start in 1886 with one of the first cases that established corporations as legal persons under the law. It was the case called Santa Clara County versus the Southern Pacific Railroad. And what happened in this case was the California legislature passed an amendment within their own constitution that would prohibit railroad corporations from deducting their debts in terms of mortgages from the payable tax that they had to do. And it's a little bit of a complicated tangential issue, but ultimately they were giving the corporation less economic rights and fewer economic rights and no equal protection under the economic laws of the country that they were going to give to sole proprietors and that they were going to give to private individuals. And that was harmful because the corporation was essentially just made up of individuals acting in collective economic interest. And so the Supreme Court found in the 14th Amendment that those individuals acting collectively were entitled to the same property protections and were entitled not to special rights, but equal protection under the law, as were sole proprietors or any other private individual. And so what this allows us to do, this legal fiction of corporations as persons, allows us to protect equally the economic rights of collective individuals, the same as it does private individuals. But it doesn't just allow us to protect their rights. It also allows us to hold them accountable in courts of laws as defendants in criminal cases and in civil cases. Now, one of the real bedrocks of our, you know, modern economic innovation and our society is the concept of a limited liability corporation, and that's the whole basis under which corporations are established. That if I own shares in Apple or if I own shares in Google, I'm not going to be held accountable for their debts past zero. Sure, my stock value can plummet to zero, but I'm not going to then be held liable for any debts that company incurs just because I'm an investor. That's a limited liability corporation. But what that means is that it's hard when a company commits some serious act of fraud or some serious act of, you know, criminal negligence to then hold them accountable within court, because all of the shareholders are collectively limited liability. So to be able to have them be sole defendants themselves and be able to have the corporation held accountable within court is a really important thing that we have, a really important legal fiction to hold them accountable. And just as we don't want to give them too many rights in terms of limited liability, we also don't want to take away their right to defend themselves within court. So it's important that they have their stance in court, that they be able to defend themselves, and that they be able to be held accountable. Go ahead, Brittany.
Matt gave you an example of his, in his speech in which a corporation used its right to personhood to avoid getting search and seizure, which ultimately led to harmful working conditions for the person within that company. Tell me how you can solve for that with corporate personhood.
Okay. The exact same way that was the reason they used that case was the exact same way that a private individual or a private business would be able to use the restriction on the search and seizure unjustly. That doesn't mean that corporations can't be searched. That doesn't mean that corporations can't be seized. That only means that corporations can't be searched and seized without the same due process of law afforded to any other group. Legal protections are not a bad thing, and they don't mean that we can't enforce our laws and govern effectively. It just means that we can't do it lazily and in an authoritarian Soviet way. So let's talk about why Citizens United is a bit of a red herring and why this specter of unlimited corporate donations and unlimited corporate money is really a red herring. Because honestly, Matt and I are outraged at the Citizens United ruling too. When the billionaire Koch brothers can use unlimited amounts of their personal financial wealth to influence the outcome of elections through unlimited donations to super PACs, which are oftentimes run by people so closely related to the candidates themselves, we think that's a real problem. But what we would be even more outraged by, and what we would think is even a bigger problem, is when Planned Parenthood isn't allowed to then respond just because they collect their money and just because they collect their donations and their revenue from a variety of people, from people who aren't the billionaire private sole proprietors that we see with the Koch brothers, that we see with the super wealthy. We think that corporations and those types of corporations should have their rights equally protected too, just because they aren't owned by a single individual, but because they conglomerate collective action. And as Matt's going to talk about, this isn't just a business thing. If New York Times loses its right to be protected, even though the individuals within the New York Times will never have their First Amendment rights obstructed, the New York Times, as an owner of printing presses, as an owner of news distribution outlets, faces undue or unlegal seizure or unprotected seizure of its own means of communication as well. And we think that's a real harm. So lastly, I want to talk about why corporations are going to be people, no matter what. It's just a question of whether we want them to be American people or Chinese people. Now, right now, the United States is competing internationally for manufacturing jobs, for different types of production jobs, and honestly, as we all know, we're sort of losing that fight to different countries like India and China. Now, traditionally, companies have preferred the stability, the protections, the due process that comes along with the United States' legal and social system of governance. On the other hand, India and China and other countries have really cheap labor. If we do away with our legal protections, if we do away with the stability that we have within our system of governance for corporations, the long-term forecast and protected financial decisions that corporations can make, we will strike the single most destructive blow against American international competitiveness that we could do today. I mean, if we're going to drive companies out of our country, let's at least do it by raising their taxes and taking their money first. This offers us no real benefit, but only serves to undercut the rights that businesses should have, and for that reason, we have to oppose. Thank you.
Finishes his speech by telling you that corporations are going to flee if we don't have protections for them, because labor is cheaper in India and labor is cheaper in China. And I say that if labor is cheaper in India and labor is cheaper in China, they are going to flee anyway. They are leaving anyway. These corporations are going to these places because they're cheaper, not because they have less protections. I'm going to bring to you today 2 points proving to you why Citizens United is not necessarily a red herring, but just the most pressing issue we see with corporate personhood. First, I'm going to tell you that money is power. Second, I'm going to tell you that there is a power disparity between people and corporations. But I'm going to do a little bit more deconstruction on what Wiley brought to you today and what Matt brought to you in POIs. So Matt's POI and what Wiley brought to you in his speech was that we have things like NAACP and we have things like Planned Parenthood that are really like respectable places, and we should totally allow them to have corporate personhood rights. And then Matt uses specifically the language ideological institutions within his POI to my partner Matt. They're both named Matt. We think that that is the the primary problem, is that we have different corporations that have different competing interests that will necessarily infringe upon the rights or, like, add to the rights of the people. We think that that is the problem. We don't think that Planned Parenthood, as a corporation, should be able to dip into its treasury to pursue its political agenda any more than we think that, like, ExxonMobil should be able to dip into its treasury to pursue its own political agenda. Furthermore, Wiley tells you that this corporate personhood allows us to protect equally the rights of the corporations and the individuals, completely negating the fact that Matt told you in his speech that we see that corporations are abusing their rights to personhood. They're using this title of person and extending it far beyond the scope of what it was ever meant to be. We have seen protection turned into exploitation, and we think that is ultimately a really bad thing. So I'm going to get into my speech now of how money is power and how there is a power disparity between people and the corporations. So what I'm telling you and what Matt told you in our speech is that when you give corporations the right to personhood, when you tell them that they are natural persons, you are saying, therefore, that they deserve the rights that an individual with flesh and blood like you and I deserve. And we think that that is a really slippery slope that has actually come to fruition. I normally don't like to use that kind of logic, but it's something that has actually worked in our political process with corporate personhood. So why is it so important? Well, we see that money is power. We understand that Citizens United is like the little like love child of corporate personhood, which is like the fruition of everything that corporations wanted from their title to corporate personhood. Go ahead.
Nowhere in the majority ruling of Citizens United is corporate personhood ever mentioned. It's about allowing anybody with money to spend unlimited amounts of money. It's just a question of whether corporations have equal protection.
It is allowing corporations with money to spend as much money out of their own treasuries as they want. The thing that ties it back to corporate personhood is that it is a matter of free speech, and that speech is equated to money, or money is equated to speech. Therefore, if people have the right to free speech, and if corporations are people, then they have the right to free speech, and they have the right to spend unlimited amounts of money. That is why this is directly related to corporate personhood and is also the most relevant given that we are in an election cycle. So, Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission allowed corporations to dip into their treasury for about as much money as they wanted to donate to political action committees, forming things called super political action committees that are able to donate tens of millions of dollars or more, if they get more, to whatever political ideology or candidate that they would like. We see that their money is power in two different places. First in elections, and second in legislation. We see that in elections over the past 12 years, the winner for Congress, for a Congress seat, and the winner for a Senate seat has outspent their competitors by almost $400,000 on average. We understand that money is at least correlated, if not causated, to whether or not you can actually get that seat. Furthermore, we understand that it's most important in election or in legislation, because a person who wins their seat by being funded by Chevron or Pepsi or Cola or ExxonMobil knows that the only way that they're probably going to get that seat again come next election cycle is if they have that same financing. So we think that they're going to use their legislative power to work in favor of the corporations that sponsored them in the first place. We think that could be a really negative thing. So that's what I'm going to do for you. My second point is tell you why that's so bad, and that's because there's a power disparity between the people and corporations for three primary reasons. No, thank you. First, there's a difference in interest between people and corporations. Second, there's a difference in the capital that they possess. And third, there's a difference in the buy-in of the members of that group. So first, there's a difference in interest. We understand, I'm going to give you an example of West Virginia. There's a coal mining group in West Virginia called, I believe, Consol Energy, if I have that right. Consol Energy, along with a bunch of other energy groups, donated almost $30.2 million to Mitt Romney's Super Political Action Committee. Now, why did they do this? Because, as I'm sure you all know, Mitt Romney stands strong and firm for business deregulation and for environmental protection deregulation and seeks to have the EPA removed as a government entity. Why is this so important to people like Chevron and ExxonMobil and Consol? We think that it's really important because they don't have to be regulated. If they don't have to be regulated, they can exploit their industry to the best of their ability. So why is this particularly important between the people and the corporations? We understand that in West Virginia, where Consol actually is actively mining, they're blowing off mountaintops, which is like contaminating the water, contaminating the soil, and contaminating the air. There are over 300 people involved in a class action lawsuit trying to get them out of there so they can have better water and better like health in the area. We think that it's a really bad thing when Consol can use their money to sway legislation and to sway the representatives to not have these regulations when the people are necessarily being harmed. What's more important is the people that belong to Consul work in that area and are facing the same kind of health harms that the people who don't work for that mine are facing. That's where the difference of member buy-in comes from, is that you have people who belong to a corporation but don't actually belong to the political ideology of that corporation. And we think that they're being unfairly represented by the corporation that uses the money that they make for them to sway them. But most importantly, corporations have far more money than you and I do. We think that they can spend millions of dollars, whereas you and I, at best, could spend a couple hundred, if not thousands. The people that can spend ridiculous amounts of money, the individuals, are typically the CEOs of the corporations that are already investing millions of dollars. So this is a short reason why corporations should not be recognized as persons. Corporate personhood has opened Pandora's box for the abuse of rights and the oppression of the voice of natural persons. We should absolutely not let that happen. We can regulate them without allowing them to exploit us and our rights. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, before I go into the constructive matter of my speech, of my two main points that both reinforce and deepen the analysis that my partner offered you, one about corporate personhood being necessary, a necessary establishment, and then the second point being is that the issue of corporate personhood in all actuality should be a nonpartisan issue, and you shouldn't allow the proposition to misconstrue this issue as many others are doing presently. But before I go on, I'm going to address some of the points that Brittany just brought to us, and that was that this issue of, of money being power, and that it's just not fair that some people have this unlimited amount of money to spend. But Wiley already addressed that we agree that it's unfair that there's individuals who have unlimited pay caps. In fact, corporate personhood existed before the Citizens United case in which those pay caps were deficient. Why don't we just reinstate what was put out with the Citizens United case with legislative action and then let it continue so that we have all the benefits that having corporate persons without any of the harms that they are trying to give to you today. I think on that point alone, we've just won the debate, but I'll continue anyway since I have one. Before I go on, Brittany.
What I told you is that corporate personhood is what allowed for these harms to exist in the first place. It's what allowed for them to resist search and seizure or to spend as much money as they want under free speech. If you take away corporate personhood but keep regulation, you get the best of both worlds.
All right. So, I was going to go more into why corporate personhood is so necessary, but to, and like all the functions that it proposes, as Wiley has already brought up, why the New York Times has protections of free speech, why we know who to sue and who to get mad at, and why small businesses and other organizations of political nature can compete with just a simple billionaire and his sole proprietorship. But so I'm just going to get more into that, and that it still stands that we can have all of the benefits that both of us would like to have by siding with the opposition's case. So, and I had some more deconstruction, I'll just get into the constructive matter here, is that, oh, the other thing is that currently when you have corporate personhood, is that you have to be able to declare, when corporations are allowed to donate to people as a group, declare who is spending. If we take away corporate personhood, then we take away that necessity to actually declare who is spending. Spending is still happening, we just don't know who it is. We can't look online, we can't look up to see who is spending, and people have worked around it before. And then going on about why personhood is the necessary legal fiction, that the principle of legal personality has existed, in fact, for centuries, since the 18th century, and is found in nearly every legal system to some extent around the world. But what we have in the United States, what we have in Western liberal democracies, is that we have rights and privileges that extend to the nature of free speech. We have rights and privileges of legal standing for those corporations, that we can't just seize their property or take away and abridge their rights. And that what was brought to you with international competition, brought up with my partner Wiley, is that if we take away one of the only things that we have that could possibly make a corporation or company want to stay in the United States, then they have no reason then not to go elsewhere. They have no reason then not to exist elsewhere and look for international venues. And that we see is that there's also always have been limits. This idea that it's this unrestricted barrier that corporations are persons, that it equates them with a natural, living, breathing person. That's simply not the case. The term personhood is a legal fiction. But the very fact that a corporation can't marry, can't hold public office, can't walk up to your door, knock on it, and ask to take out your daughter to a dinner and a movie. I mean, we recognize that they are not living, breathing, physical persons, but we do recognize is that the fiction of corporate personhood in that sense allows for and facilitates a lot of the necessary functions of a corporation, such as having contracts, such as being able to be held liable for crimes that it commits. And then, and going on to my Oh, and to my second point, before I do, just to mention that corporate personhood is also just a natural extension of the rights of human beings, and that human beings have the freedom of association that ought to be protected as social animals, that we get together in groups, we get together in positions, we get together in PTAs, churches, synagogues, mosques, we contribute to associations like Planned Parenthood, we pay union dues. These are all things that are essential parts of our lives, and these organizations that we identify with would not have any constitutional protections from invasion from the government without having corporate personhood in place to protect them. And it facilitates that right. And actually, before I go on to my second point, as I should be nonpartisan, I will take my oath.
Okay, look, there's a clear differentiation between legal protections afforded to corporations, like the ability to sign contracts and hire employees and to self-govern, and basic human rights that are afforded to people, like the right to free speech, the right to vote, things like that. And we see corporations abusing those human rights that they've so basically stolen through the use of legal inveiglery.
About how corporations shouldn't have the right to free speech or something like that is that the only reason why we have corporations as persons for in the as the amendment is accepted that corporations are persons is because it facilitates the goals of the people that embody it in the sense, and that it facilitates the goal of free speech and free press. What good is a protection of free press or free speech if the New York Times could be seized at any time, could be censored at any time, restricting maybe the employees therein with their individual rights, being able to pass out handbills or knock on your door? It cuts off voices, it cuts off necessary freedoms that we all would like to be a part of and have as necessary for democracy. So this is why corporate personhood should be a nonpartisan issue, is that this issue has turned into something that pits progressives against conservatives, but that shouldn't at all be the case. In fact, progressives benefit from corporations. Progressives have had their monumental achievements largely attributed to benefiting from corporations that have used free speech. The case that was the deciding factor in Roe v. Wade was Planned Parenthood versus Casey. The case that was crucial in the civil rights movement was the NAACP versus Burton. The New York Times used its right to free speech to publish the Pentagon papers and expose Richard Nixon. Even though he tried to block them, he could not because they were protected as a corporate person. And then we see is that Rumsfeld versus Fair was the corporation that challenged the policy of don't ask, don't tell, and pushed for it to be lifted as well. And then we see that personhood is not at all the issue. The disagreement over corporate personhood is simply the red herring, as my partner said. And the discrepancy is over the unlimited spending in the Citizens United case. But a limit could be extended over corporate persons, like other limits, but regarding campaign finances. And the amendment, an amendment to be passed to get rid of corporate personhood would have to go through 2/3 in both chambers of Congress and ratified by 3/4 of the state, and could easily fail since even progressives are divided on the issue. But rather, we could have a more narrowly tailored law come about through legislative or regulatory enactments, needing a majority in Congress, and this could achieve potentially beneficial change without the wide sweeping consequences of having an amendment in place that blocked corporate personhood. That's why we're proud to propose. Thank you.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with the nationally and internationally top-ranked UAA Seawolves speech and debate team. Corporate personhood was the subject of their debate, recorded at UAA on February 2nd.
Thank you all. Awesome job as always. It's always such a pleasure to watch them do this. And as I say every time, I come back each time because I'm trying to learn how to use that mechanism that they use in my own life. When I have arguments with people, I go, they don't stop talking. I don't get it. So I have to keep coming to these things to see if I can catch on. Anyways, I wanted to just call to your attention the fact that whenever we pick the topics for these debates, we try to pick something timely. And we were so thrilled, just to make ourselves look good, that in the Daily News, somebody just brought me this article from yesterday. Maybe you all know about this, but it starts off saying Alaska Democratic lawmakers Wednesday proposed a move toward amending the U.S. Constitution to ban unlimited third-party spending in campaigns. The resolution is a direct response to the 2010 U.S. Supreme Court decision that allows corporations and unions to give unlimited amounts to outside groups in support of or in opposition to candidates for office. And so forth. It goes on about that. And then there is a second bill that has been also introduced, House Bill 244, called Corporations Not Persons in Elections, an act providing that for-profit corporations and limited liability companies organized in this state are not persons for purposes of influencing the outcome of public office, elections, initiatives, referendums, or recalls. So what we're talking about tonight is happening as we speak, and I'm glad we're having this discussion. So part of my stealth agenda always for doing these debates is to show off our students. We also want to show off our faculty, and we have four of them who I hope will come up and join us now or have our faculty response panel as the next piece of the evening. And really the overall intention here is to make the resources of the university available to the community as we wrestle with policy issues that matter. There's an extraordinary amount of work, research, scholarship, and thinking that goes on here that we hope to make available to everyone. So I've asked the faculty again if they will each speak about 5 minutes about the issues that we're looking at from the standpoint of their disciplines. They are not necessarily here to represent their personal opinions, although often you will be able to tell what they are. So you all can decide who gets to go first. Clayton, it looks like you lose. So you're on. This is Clayton Trotter from Business Law. Next to him is Jason Brandeis from our Justice Center, Steve Haycox from History, and Forrest Neighbors with Political Science. And Steve, you're also with Liberal Studies, right?
Yes. Okay. First of all, I think I just want to thank you for the privilege of being here. This is quite an event. In fact, to have more people than I have in most of my classes to attend an event like this is a real treat. And by the way, if you'd like to take, I have three courses right now I'm teaching in business law, business law one, business law two, real estate law. And we do address the issues of corporations and how they operate and how they function in the world and go into great detail. So I could lecture here for 3 or 4 hours if you'd like. But I think the starting place, and I noticed that Jason here has a copy of the United States Constitution. Obviously, the impact of an amendment like this on the Constitution would be significant. The First Amendment of the United States Constitution, which, by the way, was decided on or based the decision of last year on the corporate spending, says in the First Amendment that Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. It is probably the single most powerful bulwark for our freedoms that exists in the United States Constitution. And part of that amendment, which was, or more than one part of that amendment, was addressed in this, in allowing corporations to spend their money. First of all, those of us who earn their money on a daily basis, if we want to get a message out, by and large, the only way we can do it, although the internet is creating enormous opportunities for getting our own messages out, is to use our money. So political parties or organizations will collect our money to pool that money in order to get a message out. So the First Amendment right to freedom of speech in the press is would be significantly impinged by saying corporations weren't persons. Secondly, the freedom of association. A corporation, for example, like we've mentioned Planned Parenthood, we've mentioned the NAACP, but also a corporation like IBM. A corporation, this university is probably organized as a nonprofit corporation. Any corporation then that would not be able to address the legislature on any subject. So students at this university would not be allowed to go to Juno to talk about getting more money for education. The professors here could not go and talk about getting more money for education because we simply couldn't use any of the money of the university to lobby for any more money for the university, which of course is something that we all participate in one form or another. So it would be a very difficult thing for all the corporations to not have personhood. Additionally, I have been in the past a plaintiff's lawyer. Now, for those of you that know the distinction between plaintiff's lawyers and defense lawyers, is defense lawyers defend corporations, by and large, insurance companies, major corporations. Plaintiff's lawyers represent people. And we sue corporations. And if you don't have personhood, my first question as a lawyer is, well, who do I sue? And another question that arises, if you eliminate personhood, is who owns the property? In the medieval era, one of the reasons they developed corporations, and by the way, they were developed in monastic societies in Italy in like 12th, 13th century, is because when the abbot died, nobody knew what to do with his stuff. And so they had to create an artificial entity to passively hold property so that it would go from one, you know, it wouldn't, one abbot dies, it doesn't matter, the monastery continues. The chancellor of the university dies, the corporation entity of the university continues. If you break down that personhood, it's going to throw all kinds of wrenches from a business law profession perspective into the works. Another thing, corporations are owned by people. Major corporations in the United States, the ownership, frankly, is little old ladies in tennis shoes. Okay, now that's not disparaging. I'm not trying to despair little old ladies in tennis shoes. But on average, ladies outlive us, gentlemen, by 7 years. And typically, the husband will be working in the corporation accumulating stock or purchasing stocks after they invest the money that they gain, and then they die. And the stockholders in most major corporations are elderly ladies, over 55. If you deny personhood to them, then you're going to have a real problem discerning who owns this, who owns the stock? Because where's the person that's supposed to hold the stock, and where's the person that's going to distribute those shares to the shareholders when they want to turn them in? My mother turned in some stock that she took most of her life earning late in her life and was able to live quite comfortably because she's able to cash it in. Eliminating personhood is going to cause some real problems from a business law perspective. And that's more than 5 minutes, and I apologize, but it's not 3 hours, so.
Thank you.
I want to thank the Starbucks Corporation for making my appearance here possible tonight. I also want to say, Colleen, it's really impressive that you were just able to rattle off the First Amendment to the Constitution so clearly like that. And I think that First Amendment issues related to corporate personhood are one of the reasons why we're here and why this is an issue. The idea of corporate personhood is nothing new. It's been around for hundreds and hundreds of years, though it hasn't, the words corporate and person didn't appear in our Supreme Court jurisprudence until the 1890s. But I think that, this question of whether the Constitution should be amended to ban corporate personhood is a difficult one, and personally, I've struggled with it a lot ever since Libby called and asked me if I would participate in this. And we were looking at this from the perspective of a discipline. I'm a lawyer as well by training, and I work in the Justice Center. But my personal view is to always support the underdog, and here the underdog I think is corporations. And we're talking about restricting the rights of corporations. So I found myself, 60% of the time over the last week that I've been thinking about this, I found myself wanting to defend and support corporations, which sometimes as an individual, something that I don't necessarily agree with. But I've gone back and forth on this quite a bit, and I have worked in the past as a lawyer for the ACLU, which takes a very strong position about free speech rights, particularly money being free speech rights. And the ACLU actually submitted a brief in support of Citizens United in the Citizens United decision. But I've also worked for the state of Alaska enforcing the state's campaign finance laws, so I understand the need for regulation to some extent in speech, especially when it comes to politics. So given this, this background, I've been on both sides of the issue, and I thought that what I would like to do tonight is to listen to what people have to say to see if I could be convinced to come out one way or another. But I have a couple of points that I wanted to make. I think a couple of things that I think are really salient and important here. And one is that amending the Constitution for anything is a really big deal, right? The Constitution has not been amended many times. And it is difficult, very, very difficult to amend the Constitution. It is a long, arduous process. There's a very high standard that has to be met. It is also very expensive, right? Think about the political campaigns that go on now. Well, a campaign to amend the Constitution, which, whether it's done through each two-thirds of each house of the federal Congress voting to amend the Constitution, then having to be ratified by three-quarters of the states, it can take years. It will be extremely expensive. We'd have a lot of corporate influence and money, perhaps, involved in that, which would make things even more interesting and complicated. But I think that even more so than the difficulty in amending the Constitution, we have to be really careful about how we amend it and what we say. And an amendment that simply said corporations should not be considered people or corporate personhood is banned, I think would be highly, highly ineffective. And we need to be really careful about what it is that we're seeking to do by banning corporate personhood and then tailoring a constitutional amendment very specifically to get at that. The other points that I wanted to make very, very briefly are things that, well, the debaters all raised tonight, which made me wonder if they were listening in my office earlier today as I was discussing these things with a colleague, is that corporations are not all bad, right? They're not all evil. There are really good corporations out there that do a lot of, that provide a lot of benefits to our society. In fact, Justice Stevens, who issued a really, really lengthy dissent in the Citizens United decision that I tried really hard to read all the way through, described corporations as providing enormous contributions to our society. And Clayton mentioned several ways in which they help our society out, and there's our economic system is really based on having the ability to identify who is producing what and who can and should be sued and who owns what and where we go, and that's really dependent on the corporate structure. So I guess that's really all I'll say at this point. I think that where we are right now is, you know, at an interesting time because our view of corporate culture in America has sort of been galvanized by the Citizens United decision. Citizens United didn't raise any really incredibly new points. It changed laws a little bit, but it didn't raise any new issues, right? The idea of corporate personhood and corporate speech has been around for a while, but it certainly served to initiate a lot of debate, and that's sort of why we're here tonight. So I'm really curious to hear what everyone else on the panel has to say.
You're not an attorney, are you?
No.
I might correct you anyway.
Getting a little uneasy when I'm... I'd like to provide just a little bit of historical perspective. But first, I would like to suggest that to paint with too broad a brush is misleading, and Jason does a good job of helping us pull back from that a little bit. We're really not going to be discussing, if this amendment goes anywhere, getting rid of personhood for corporations. It will be rather, as the resolution offered today or yesterday by Senators Bill Wilikowski and Hollis French and by Representative Les Guerra, the denial of personhood and the conference of personhood for specific purposes. That's what will be at issue. As Jason and Clay remind us, corporations have been around for a long time, and they provide necessary services, not just economically, but as we have heard, culturally and politically. So the issue is what shall be the power of the corporation operating as a person? How much power do we want to give the corporation to function as a person? This issue came up at the beginning of the 20th century. Industrialization had begun to mature by that time, and corporations were able to capture certain functions in society that people considered to be necessities. For example, public utilities, supplying power, or water supply, or sewage runoff, or that sort of thing. And John D. Rockefeller, with Standard Oil, could control how long people could stay up at night, because he controlled the price of kerosene, which is what people used for light, and how long they could stay up before they had to go to bed and get under the downy or the comforter, because they used that same kerosene to fuel the heat in their house. And if the price was too high, you couldn't buy enough kerosene, and you had to go to bed early, and you couldn't read at night. And people thought, wait a minute, that's a little bit too much power. That's not a corporation operating in the public interest. That's a corporation operating against the public interest. And they moved to curtail that. In the Tillman Act in 1907, Congress took away from corporations the issue that is really most at hand today. And that issue was unlimited spending in political campaigning. That's what has got everybody upset, and I would argue properly so. And so that's where we come to today. President Obama gave a speech in Osawatomie, Kansas, last December, just a couple of months ago, and he addressed this issue some. I'd like to share with you a speech that was given in Osawatomie, Kansas, in 1910, when the culture was addressing this issue. It was by a different president, Theodore Roosevelt. Here is one of the things that he said. The Constitution guarantees protection to property, and we must make that promise good. But it does not give the right of suffrage to any corporation. There can be no effective control of corporations while their political activity remains.
To put an end to it will be neither a short nor an easy task, but it can be done. Corporate expenditures for political purposes, and especially such expenditures by public service corporations, have supplied one of the principal sources of the corruption in our political affairs. President Obama could just as well have quoted Theodore Roosevelt in his Osawatomie speech in December. Let me close with two more little quotes from from Teddy Roosevelt. These are not in the Osawatomie speech, but they are contemporaneous with it. First, these corporate donors are the most dangerous members of the criminal class, the malefactors of great wealth. And in another time, another place, he said, "It tires me to talk to rich men. You expect a man of millions to be worth hearing. But as a rule, they don't know anything but their own business."
This is KESKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with the award-winning UAA Seawolves Speech and Debate Team. Corporate personhood was the subject of their debate, recorded at UAA on February 2, 2012. Following the arguments presented by the students, you heard three of the four faculty responses from UAA professors Clayton Trotter, Jason Brandeis, and Steve Haycox. You can hear the last faculty response from Professor Forrest Neighbors, along with the complete public response and discussion that followed the debate on alaskapublic.org. Special thanks to the Department of University Advancement, who recorded this week's program for the UAA Green and Gold podcast. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.